Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, a program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to God's glory and that of his kingdom. It's always a very bracing time here at Securing America when we get to visit with one of our regulars. His name is Charles Sam Faddis. He brings an extraordinary background to bear on, well, most important issues challenging the security of our country at the moment, namely as, among other things, a former Army officer, an undercover Central Intelligence Agency operative, a candidate for Congress, an author of best-selling books, fiction and nonfiction, including Beyond Repair, The Decline and Fall of the CIA. He is the driving force behind a terrific online resource these days, andmagazine.com, which you can find at Substack. It's great to have you back, Sam. Welcome.
Great to be here as always, Frank. Thank you.
You have been one of those who has hopefully been raising up and explicating Hunter Biden's laptop for quite some time now. Mutual friend and colleague of ours, Jack Maxey, has been doing some terrific work making it more accessible. Give us an update about, well, both what we now know is on that laptop, what it has told us about Joe Biden and his compromise, and the implications going forward from here.
Right. Well, look, we've gone through the phase where the line from the mainstream media was the laptop is a fake, the Russians did it. Pay no attention to that. Okay, so we've now finally broken through that wall, and folks are beginning to admit what everybody with any sense has known for a long time, which is all of that is not true. This is real. This is Hunter Biden's laptop. The new line of defense in this game is Hunter is corrupt. Good Lord, God knows what Hunter's up to. But of course, Joe had no knowledge of this, no involvement in this, and it doesn't touch him at all. That's nothing to see here, move on, or as we would call it in the intel business, and as I think Jim Biden said at one point to Bob Alinsky, plausible deniability. The boss knew nothing. This is just another line, there's another line of defense, not true. What the laptop shows in spades is that, and what a lot of other evidence shows, is that this is a family enterprise. This is Hunter Biden selling access to Joe Biden. That's crystal clear. So that's where we are.
Among the other evidence, of course, is Tony Bobulinski himself, who participated in meetings in which that was made plain to him, as I understand it. So if Joe Biden has in fact been directly compromised and knowingly so by his son Hunter, by among others, the Chinese Communist Party, Sam, we've talked about this repeatedly in the past, but as the evidence is now amassing and becoming more and more compelling to the point where I think that latest line of defense is beginning to break down. Tucker Carlson, among others, has been talking about how the Democrats are now evidently preparing to get rid of Biden. He's become such a liability to them. What does it tell us about the national security risks that were being run as long as such an individual is the commander-in-chief of the United States?
Right. Well, what's critical for people to understand here is, okay, so this is obviously Joe, and Joe is compromised. But this is not like somebody could blackmail Joe or somebody could do something to Joe. This already happened. This happened years ago. This guy was bought by the Chinese Communist Party, by a number of other folks, but the Chinese Communists put more money into this than everybody else combined. So we have a guy sitting in the Oval Office who it appears is owned by our number one enemy on the planet. Now, so you ought to take a look at every national security decision, every decision he's made since he sat down in the chair, and really run it through this filter of, are you really sure that all you're looking at is incompetence? Because it sure looks like a wrecking operation to me.
Fun of calling it just that, of course. And Sam, I guess the point is, it's not just the international decisions that he's been making, and those are deplorable as they clearly are to most Americans, I think, notably Afghanistan and now Ukraine. But it's every domestic policy as well, it seems to me, needs to be run through that same sort of filter. And when you do that, even without, you know, a full-on investigation or prosecution, just common sense tells you it's got sort of two qualities to it. One is the one you just mentioned. It's all to the detriment of the United States, but it seems as though it's all either very directly or at least indirectly to the benefit of the Chinese Communist Party, our mortal enemy.
Yeah, without question, Frank. Every decision, beginning with the very first decision I think he made when he sat down in the Oval Office, which is shut down the Keystone Pipeline and begin waging what some folks have called jihad on the American oil and gas industry.
When you've written a wonderful piece comparing Joe Biden's defense of his son to Don Corleone defending his young Sonny offspring, where does it leave us that Biden is still trying to hold this line that there's no problem here, folks? He's actually making the case that there's no problem with Hunter either, as far as I can tell. But it speaks to both the character of the individuals involved, it seems to me, as well as their compromise. If that's the case, is it your expectation that they will be subjected to prosecution? Is there any evidence that there's a grand jury examining all of this? Or do you anticipate that they'll simply be forced out? I say they, Joe specifically, be forced out by the Democrats in favor of, God help us, Kamala and company.
Well, I think what is vital is that there must be prosecution and we must have accountability, right? And now at some point, the political play may be cut away Joe and make him exit stage right and hope everybody forgets about this. And given what we're talking about, I mean, we're talking about the president of the United States being compromised by the Chinese Communist Party and owned by Xi Jinping. So I don't really think him just getting up and leaving and somebody else sitting down adequately addresses that. We've got to get to the bottom.
And especially so, Sam, as we've discussed on a number of occasions, thanks to your great work and that of Trevor Loudon at the Accountability Initiative, there's going to have to be sort of a roto-rooting of this administration to remove an awful lot of other people that it seems are deeply compromised as well, including the guy running your old agency, Bill Burns.
Head of the CIA, the National Security Advisor, the Secretary of State, our ambassador to the United Nations. That's just getting us started, right? All of those folks are compromised as well.
Avril Haines, I think, the DNI among them too. This is, it's so easy to forget all of them. But the point is that if people are interested in the evidence of that kind of compromise, I encourage them to go to accountabilityinitiative.org, as well as, of course, your work at andmagazine.com. Sam, we have to take a short break. On the other side, I want to talk with you a bit more about, among other things, this CCP threat. The virus, for one thing, and the evidence that we now have that the State Department knew that it likely came out of the laboratory, and yet we've been lied to about that incessantly. And more broadly, the degree to which we're watching Joe Biden helping the CCP in material manner that is to the detriment of our, national security, our economic interests, our freedoms, not least by, I think, importing here something very akin to the Chinese model, as they call it, the social credit system and all of the tyrannical things that flow from it. We'll get back to that with more of Sam Faddis right after this. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Conventional wisdom, supported by recent polling, says Republicans will succeed in taking back the House and possibly the Senate in November's elections. The Senate's GOP caucus yesterday showed how they can still lose. Rather than utilize the full 30 hours afforded them for post-cloture debate on the nomination of Ketanji Brown Jackson to be an Associate Justice of the Supreme Court, every single one of the 50 Republican senators acquiesced to a sharply truncated discussion of her radical record and problematic judgment. Three of them actually voted for Judge Jackson's confirmation. Knowing they would, the rest opted to vote no quickly and then go on vacation. They thereby missed an historic teachable moment, failing to inoculate the Supreme Court against Justice Jackson's expected hard leftist activism and alienating voters seeking representatives who will relentlessly stand and fight for their values and freedom. This is Frank Gaffney. We're back, and we are joined by the great Sam Faddis, a former CIA undercover operative turned one of the great analysts of momentous developments in our country, and you can follow his work at andmagazine.com and Substack. Sam, I talked a moment ago about not just the threat from China in the abstract and the help that they're getting from Joe Biden, but about one particular example of this, and that is in the pandemic environment, the so-called CCP virus, the Chinese Communist Party virus that was unleashed upon us back in 2019 and the rest of the world, of course, we have seen a number of steps taken that have greatly diminished our freedoms, and I would argue our security. And we now have evidence that the State Department was sufficiently confident very early on in this crisis that the source of it was, in fact, a laboratory that is part of the Chinese illegal biological warfare program. Connect some dots here for us as to what the implications of that are and what is seemingly flowing from it in terms of sort of the imposition of the China model, as they call it here.
Well, the State Department, I think what you're making reference to is that there's a memo that has surfaced, I think, literally within the last few days. And it dates back to, I believe, April 2020. And it's a State Department internal memo. And they're talking about where this thing come from. And they go through all the, they identify like five possibilities. And they go through it and very succinctly conclude that the most logical common sense explanation based on all the data we have, is that this thing came out of the Wuhan lab. It's very upfront. It's very clear.
All the data we had back in April of 2020, no less.
April 2020 memo, they've already analyzed all this information, and that's what they're saying. And they're also very clear that the Chinese are preventing anybody from getting to the bottom of it.
And this raises the question, Sam, when we're talking about that, there was a Avril Haines, the director of national intelligence, pushed out an intelligence assessment that said, oh, we just can't really figure this out. That was late last year, as I recall. So how do we square what they knew back in April of 2020 and what they said to the American people in the fall of 2021?
Well, of course, the memo, it didn't occur in isolation. I mean, we don't have time to go through everything, but the memo is completely consistent with what the Department of State reporting had actually been showing even before the pandemic, that the Wuhan lab was a disaster waiting to happen. In fact, they specifically had said like 2 years earlier, we could have a pandemic originating here. So there's no explanation really as a matter of common sense other than the assessment was cooked. Right. They didn't produce what the intelligence community is supposed to produce, which is an objective, as best we can determine, analysis without who cares what the politics are. That's not the job of the IC. They, just like they did in Benghazi, they produced a cooked analysis that suited the political purposes of the Biden administration.
Cooking the books is something that unfortunately is not unique to this administration, but to the extent that it does benefit the Chinese Communist Party, it is a particular concern. Sam, let me ask you to work us through a complex problem. You've spent during your distinguished undercover career a fair amount of time in a country called Pakistan in support of our efforts to secure Afghanistan against the Taliban, which was operating from safe havens there. We've learned recently that the Taliban in Pakistan is now swearing fealty to the Taliban in Afghanistan and going for the overthrow of the Pakistani government. I'm interested in, as a thought experiment with you, where does China come out in all of this? Pakistan is their ally, very important ally. The Taliban is their new friend. Are they rooting for the Taliban to overthrow the Pakistani government and presumably usher in a new, more, even if it's possible, jihadist government there in Islamabad? Or are they going to be helping the Pakistani government hold the line against their new friends?
Well, look, I think they're going to try to straddle all of this. And in the short term, what they're looking for is to loot Afghanistan of minerals and everything else that they can get out of it. This is a, you know, the Chinese are very hard-nosed on this. What's in it for us? We're not, ideology is irrelevant here.
But interests are interests. And I would assume that they do have an interest in maintaining the government of Pakistan as a reliable ally, especially, you know, with all those nuclear weapons scattered about the country.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think the wild card in all of this, I mean, the Pakistanis have played a double game with us, right? They've been in bed with the Taliban for years. The wild card in all of this is the sort of fire of jihad, if I can use that. It's, you know, the Taliban in Kabul and now their formal allies in Pakistan have their own ideas about how this is supposed to end, and that's a worldwide caliphate. So you can kind of play with them for a while and think you can control it. And after a while, I think you find out, like the Saudis did the hard way, that you look down and the ground under your feet is on fire, right?
Well, especially at a time when you are in a genocidal campaign against their co-religionists in Western China. It does seem to me, though, that they're intent on making common cause with people who may have a different end game in mind, whether it's the jihadists or whether it's the global capitalists. Confident, I guess, as the Chinese are, that they'll prevail in the end. The other guys seem to think they won't, but we'll see. The main point is, in the meantime, they're all coming for us and doing so, I think, rather more together than is safe for us. Lastly, let me ask you quickly, if I can, Sam, to talk a little bit about this deal with Iran. You've spent a lot of time focused on weapons of mass destruction and terrorism. That, in fact, was your last duty station at the CIA. We're seeing even some Democrats now turning up and saying, you know, this deal that the Biden administration is desperately trying to cut with the mullahs in Iran is so bad, is so reckless, is so irresponsible that even we can't go along with it. Talk a little bit about that and where you think this is headed.
Well, it's a disaster, and I hope it's heading to, I hope it's going to crash and burn, but it's a surrender document. We're getting ready to remove sanctions, hand billions of dollars to the Iranians. We're getting ready, we're attempting to craft a deal which will make the IRGC arguably the most powerful terrorist organization on the planet, the Revolutionary Guard Corps, to remove sanctions and
only it won't be a terrorist organization anymore. One of the things, apparently, they'll be taken off the terrorism list, for heaven's sakes. So it's just powerful and dangerous, needless to say. And to the extent that this is teeing up to be all the things that you've just said, how important is it that it be opposed and if, as you say, possible, crashed and burned, if not before it's signed, afterwards?
Look, if we go through with this deal in any semblance of the form that it's being crafted, the Iranians are going to set the Middle East on fire again, and it's going to be worse than it ever was. And the Israelis are undoubtedly going to take offensive action. So you're not just talking about terrorist action, you're talking about a war in the Middle East. I will not be surprised to find the Saudis arm themselves with nuclear weapons if you go forward. Everything that Donald Trump did with the Abraham Accords to try to finally bring peace to the Middle East, completely undone and worse than it ever was.
Yeah. Well, and not least, almost certainly a war with Israel, and that may be a nuclear war. Who knows? Sam Faddis, not cheerful tidings, but the hard truth, and it's what we expect of you, and we appreciate so much your bringing it to bear, not only here on Securing America with regularity, but of course, through your other platforms. It's vital that your voice be heard, and we're so appreciative that you take the time to do it with us. Godspeed, my friend. Keep up the great work that you do. I look forward next to talking with Jonathan Emord about the true prospects for democracy in our nation, whether tyranny is actually the agenda of a lot of people who are blathering on about it at the moment. That and more straight ahead.
Night after night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back, and a special welcome to our next guest. His name is Jonathan Emord. He is a constitutional law attorney and the author of a tremendously important book, The Authoritarians, Their Assault on Individual Liberty, the Constitution, and Free Enterprise from the 19th Century to the Present. Jonathan, it's very good to have you back with us here at Securing America. Welcome.
Great to be with you, Frank.
You have been expressing concern, and I think it's entirely warranted, and I want you to share it with our audience, about how those who are now inveighing, it seems, incessantly about threats to democracy actually seem to have a very tyrannical motivation for their protests. Give us a sense of what that actually entails and why they are masquerading their true intentions.
Well, as you know, we have a republic by design, constitutional design in this country. We were never meant to be a democracy. Democracy was kept in check intentionally by the founding fathers, who equated pure democracy with tyranny because of the tyranny of the majority. And so it is that it's interesting that many commentators refer to our country as a democracy, and it's troubling. And it's troubling because they're using actually the language of democracy writ large, which is not our language under the Constitution, and they are achieving electoral victory, and then upon achieving electoral victory, they are declaring the Constitution to be irrelevant. They are using power through unconstitutional means, such as executive orders that are actually legislative actions, which under the Constitution's Article 1 would have to originate with the Congress of the United States, it being the exclusive authority to create law. And they're using the executive branch agencies as vehicles to legislate as well. And that whole pattern of reliance on executive agencies arose in the 1800s, the late 1880s on the federal level, and was intentionally designed by those who were Hegelian socialists, really, the major advocates of the administrative state throughout the Progressive Era, to create a government outside of the Constitution's government, a government that would operate in an authoritarian manner without constitutional strictures. This was their objective, actually. They had come back from the historical schools in Germany, where they were educated in how American Republic was actually a horrible thing, that the solution to modernity, to the industrial age, was not individual rights, which they call bunk, but rather was collective rights, and that expressed by experts who would know better than we do what is in our own best interest. This philosophy is the Democratic Party's philosophy and is, in fact, the philosophy of governance in the United States today.
And I think it's important to note that it is very much of a piece with the practice of Marxists elsewhere who have used the ballot box to come to power and then promptly dispensed with the idea of having any kind of continuing accountability to the public that put them in office and instead imposed tyrannical sort of arrangements for keeping them down. So when you hear this taking place, when you witness it taking place, what should Americans be thinking and doing to try to assure that our representative form of government, our Constitution, and the freedoms that it guarantees are safeguarded, Jonathan?
Well, it's not enough to win an election against these socialists. We have to go further, and that is quite a bit further, in this way. We have to take something like, for example, the Qualifications Clause of the Constitution, which very plainly requires those who are elected to federal office and state office as well, to swear that they will support the Constitution of the United States. Now, someone like AOC, who is...
Support and defend, I think, is usually the formulation. They're supposed to be doing, actually protecting it, right?
Constitutional provision actually refers to support, but the statutory provisions also say defend. The language support, though, in the Constitution is quite literal. The use of an oath was an extraordinary thing and was meant to bind agents in their service to the government. And what you have in the form of AOC, Bernie Sanders, and these people who are self-avowed socialists, Democrat socialists, they are not qualified to be in federal office under the Constitution, actually.
It's a fascinating point. Yeah. They should be, in fact, ineligible to serve if they are not faithfully fulfilling that oath of office.
Right. They have declared themselves in advance of election and in advance of being sworn into office to be enemies of the Constitution by saying they're for socialism. Article 4, Section 4 of the Constitution is called the Guarantee Clause, and it gives a federal guarantee that every state will have a Republican form of government. It's fascinating to contemplate. The framers created a Republican form of government on the national level, required those who serve to support that Constitution, and forbade those in the states from rejecting the Republican form also. But we have Oregon that's gone over the deep end on socialism. We have Antifa and BLM that are coddled by those in the administrative state, largely because it's the fruition of what they've wanted, really, in the administrative state since its inception.
Yeah, and it also gives rise to a pretext upon which the administrative state can be even more, well, oppressive of the public. And the especially alarming piece of this, I think you will agree, Jonathan Edmund, is that we are talking about in the context of a so-called insurrection that ostensibly took place on January 6th of 2021, a comprehensive effort not only to demonize and vilify political opponents of this socialist agenda, but new pretexts found at every turn to, as I say, advance the imposition of state control and repressive control at that, and the loss of our freedoms, not just those so-called Trump voters and others charged with insurrection, but all of us. No?
Yes, and this is where we have the destruction of the rule of law, and we have politicization of the justice system. We have selective enforcement of the law to serve political ends, the total destruction of the concept of equal justice under law. And that is the ruination of really everything, because once you have combined a total disregard for the strictures of the Constitution with a politicization of the criminal justice system and a use of it to ferret out enemies and destroy them, you have indeed transformed our country into something very similar to the former Soviet Union.
Yes. We were just talking with Sam Faddis about this phenomenon of essentially weaponizing the instruments of the state. And you're absolutely right. It is maybe the Chinese Communist Party is a more apt and current comparison, because it does seem as though their agenda is to try to bring here as much as they can similar kinds of control mechanisms to those that the Chinese Communist Party uses domestically and is exporting. Very quickly, this is a very fundamental threat to our country. We're devoted here to protecting it, supporting and defending the Constitution. What should Americans listening to our conversation do now to try to help preserve our freedoms and our constitutional republic that is meant to guarantee them?
Well, in addition to becoming educated as to what your rights are and the purpose of our Constitution, which is largely defined by the second paragraph of the Declaration of Independence, we must vote out of office all those who are representative of this view that the state has no limits, that the state is to direct our future, and that individual liberty is to be run over roughshod in favor of a collectivist agenda. If we do that, and I think we will in 2022 succeed in at least flipping the House, hopefully also the Senate, then we have an opportunity. It's that opportunity which can be squandered or used to great advantage. If used to great advantage, it's time to end the administrative state. It is time to rededicate ourselves to the rule of law, to the equal application of the law, and ensure that those who, for example, the Clinton campaign committee and all of those who worked inside the FBI and the Justice Department to facilitate that fraud on the United States are brought to justice, and that we have equal justice demonstrated by our actions, not just by our words.
A terrific agenda, and one that I hope we will see put forward by the people that are standing for office, seeking a mandate from the American people to do just that. What I'm terrified of is that they'll just say, oh, well, we're not as bad as those guys, and get away without having something that they're to be held accountable to execute. Thank you for your time today. Jonathan Emord, it's great to visit with you, and I look forward to doing so with you again in the very near future. Next up, we're going to speak with an interesting foreign-born American patriot by the name of Dr. Sen Ni about something that is a hopeful sign about alienation from the Chinese Communist Party in China. That more straight ahead.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Conventional wisdom, supported by recent polling, says Republicans will succeed in taking back the House and possibly the Senate in November's elections. The Senate's GOP caucus yesterday showed how they can still lose. Rather than utilize the full 30 hours afforded them for post-cloture debate on the nomination of Ketanji Brown Jackson to be an Associate Justice of the Supreme Court, every single one of the 50 Republican senators acquiesced to a sharply truncated discussion of her radical record and problematic judgment. Three of them actually voted for Judge Jackson's confirmation. Knowing they would, the rest opted to vote no quickly and then go on vacation. They thereby missed an historic teachable moment, failing to inoculate the Supreme Court against Justice Jackson's expected hard leftist activism and alienating voters seeking representatives who will relentlessly stand and fight for their values and freedom. This is Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and I want to say a special welcome to a guest who has not been with this program before now, because I've only just made his acquaintance. His name is Dr. Sen Nui. He is a professor of mechanical engineering at Catholic University and the vice president of something called the Tui Dong Center. And he's introduced me to Tui Dong. It's fascinating. I think it is potentially of very considerable importance in our death struggle with the Chinese Communist Party. We're going to talk with him about what it is and what it might do to help us in liberating the people of China from the monstrous regime that enslaves them and menaces us. I believe that he is what I call a foreign-born American patriot, and I'm very glad to have him with us. Dr. Ni, welcome.
Thank you, Frank. It's my pleasure and honors to be invited to your program. I am originally from Taiwan and being a graduate study and stay here for almost 40 years. I have been the engineering professor at the Catholic University of America for the past 38 years.
Well, this is an impeccable record. Let me cut to the chase because we're going to run out of time to talk about Tui Dong. Tell us what that is. First of all, what does it mean in English, and what does it represent?
Tui Dong is two Chinese words. Tui literally means withdraw. Dong means the party. Withdraw from Communist Party is the Tui Dong means directly.
And what does that entail? How do people withdraw from the Chinese Communist Party? It's a relatively small percentage of the population anyway, but you're talking about people who are actually party members disengaging from it in some fashion.
Yes, more than that. There's about 1.4 billion Chinese, right, in China. There's a Chinese Communist Party. Right now, it's like they claim there's 90 million members. And there's Communist Youth League for middle school or high school kids. And there's the Communist Young Pioneers for elementary school kids. These three organizations are so-called the Communist Party and affiliates. It's about 1 billion Chinese among this 1.4 are part of these three organizations, either one or two or all three of them.
Okay, so it's a larger population. And how many people have taken the step of withdrawing from one or the other of these party apparatuses?
Yes, within the past 17 years of the Tui Dong movement, they have been 394 million, almost 400 million. Okay, brave Chinese cut the ties with Communist Party and affiliates.
And how have they done that?
Well, they have to post their statements of a withdrawal on this Tui Dong website, which is protecting a headquarters in New York City. Then This actually was triggered by a book. It's called Night Commentary on Communist Party, which is a blue-colored book. It's probably number one prohibited book in China, published about 17 years ago, which initiated Chinese to have conversation about Communist Party, what CCP is, and how CCP has done to Chinese people, the land, the environment, the society, and the culture, and the faith. How many people are killed?
When people sign up on this website, are they not putting themselves at great risk? They don't give their actual names, I assume, do they? But even the process of, you know, the electronic signature, does that not jeopardize their safety in China?
Yeah, well, it's a there are people use real names, but there are people is allowed to use nicknames, right, to protect their identity of retributions. And the feelings of Chinese people quitting the CCP organization, they feel there's a risk, could be high risk. That's the real feel in their heart. So their statement signed up is really a brave one.
It's brave, and they're taking some steps to obviously conceal their actual identity. But what about this question? The Chinese are very serious about cyber monitoring as well as cyber warfare. Is there not some risk even just, you know, registering your pseudonym on this website?
Yes, there are young people who can go with under anti-blockage softwares to register, sign their names on the website of Tuidong.
So it can be done surreptitiously.
Yeah, they can do that themselves. Or there are brave volunteers in China and abroad can help those people, particularly senior citizens, to register their name, post their statements. Okay, the statement has to have a date and time. Each one is unique, has to identify date and time, time accurate to minutes and seconds, and the name, the location, and what organization they want to withdraw, and what is the reason of withdrawal. That statement is posted on the website, and you can see that 394 million statements there, still there. And you may not know who this guy is, but the person who knows that statement is mine.
Yeah. And almost 400 million people have registered in this fashion. That's a tremendous indictment of the Chinese Communist Party, I think it's fair to say, and a testament to its illegitimacy. We have to take a short break, Dr. Nie, and I want to come back on that point, because I think delegitimating the CCP is a central focus of effort, or should be, for those of us who wish to see an end to what I call the enslavement of the people of China, as well as, of course, the threat that the Chinese Communist Party represents to us. And we've been talking in the course of this program and most of them about the nature of that threat, the unrestricted warfare that is being waged against us. So hold on. We're going to come right back with more with Dr. Sen Ni of Catholic University and the Tuidong Center right after this. Welcome back. We're talking with a most interesting professor of mechanical engineering at Catholic University, but whose passion, I think it's fair to say, is the work he does as the vice president of the Tui Dong Center in New York City. And we're discussing what Tui Dong means in terms of the legitimacy of the Chinese Communist Party. They would have you believe that it is a fact of life, it is permanent, and it is widely shared by the Chinese people. The evidence that you have compiled, Dr. Ni, and your team is very much to the contrary. And it speaks to this issue of that my old boss, Ronald Reagan, I think, was very much focused on back in the day when he was going after the other totalitarian communist regime that sought our destruction very explicitly, that of the Soviet Union. So talk about the importance to the Chinese communists of legitimacy and why it should be really a centerpiece of our effort to undermine them, that we go after that legitimacy.
Yes, Tui Dong movement is really not a political movement, because those participants, they don't know each other, they don't want to contact each other. Maybe they told their family members, but they won't tell even their friends. It's more like an individual choice where they understand how brutal, evil the CCP is. They don't want to be part of it. They just declare their renunciations of these organizations. They don't want to do any more dark things or evil things or crime. It's an individual choice, so it's more like a conscious awakening or spiritual movement. And so there is no organizations to organize them or to propose any political reforms or overthrow the CCP. It's not that case, okay? But on the other hand, this massive movement, grassroots, peaceful Chinese people, they form the foundation in China for a peaceful transitions to a China without communism, okay, which is very important not only for China, Asia, also for the world. So it's a massive peaceful forces in China that can come up with a civilized society that will benefit China and the world.
Is what can the United States and other Western countries, for that matter, who love freedom and want it for the Chinese people, do to facilitate this kind of transition? Is it something that basically starts with countering the Chinese Communist Party and creating conditions under which this large but, you know, non-coherent group of people can take advantage of an opportunity for a transition? Or is there something else that could be done, do you think?
Well, first of all, is try to raise awareness of this trade-off movement and give the moral support, spiritual support. This is the Chinese wisdom of Chinese taking care of communism within. Okay, it's cleansing the communism, the ideology concepts, while CCP is still in power. Look at the war between Ukraine and Russia. There's still communist shadows there because the East European bloc, they don't have a chance to cleansing the communism, so-called decommunization. They are doing that. But it's the afterwards. It is Chinese we are doing cleansing the communism's the effects while they are still in power. And this is the Chinese that demonstrate to the whole world they are solving their problem their own. They need more of moral support, spiritual support. Probably at that time, right now, it's not direct support that you're going to get invite retaliations.
Yeah. So moral support is, again, something that I think Ronald Reagan did brilliantly when he talked about, for example, the evil empire, and when he lifted up dissidents inside the Soviet gulags, and he otherwise challenged, as I say, the legitimacy of the regime in the Kremlin. How would you like to see the government of the United States, which unfortunately at the moment is, as we've been just talking about elsewhere in the program, rather in the pocket of the Chinese Communist Party, but the American people and representatives who really reflect their desires, I think, would be happy to provide moral support. If you have any guidance as to how that might best be done at the moment.
Yeah. First of all, need to recognize this peaceful grassroots movement. Actually, there were three resolutions in the Congress has been proposed before. It's in 2011, there's a House Resolution 416 by Congressman Tedas McCarter. Then 2012, there's a Senate Resolution 232 by Bob Menendez. And the recent one, 2018, by Congressman Dana Rohrabacher, showed the solidarity of U.S. Congress or U.S. people with the trade-off movement and encourage them, don't be afraid, do it. Okay, make your free choice. Okay, cut the tie from this evil regime. And we support you, we applaud your work. Okay, we respect you. And also the Tuidong volunteers being seriously retaliated inside China and need the world to support. Okay, so that communists won't be doing that too much.
Well, of the three sponsors of those resolutions, one is still serving. In fact, he's the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Bob Menendez, and it would be great to see what we could do to encourage him to reintroduce this piece of legislation and help in exactly these ways. Professor, thank you so much for joining us, and this is the beginning of a conversation about both your movement and what we can do to help you, and I'm so grateful for your time today. I'm so grateful for the rest of you being with us as well for this edition of Securing America. I hope you feel better equipped to do just that and that you will join us at securingamerica.tv for more about what you can do. And then you'll go forth and multiply.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.